We have six studies planned, and they'll be about 40 minutes each. And without further ado, if you can look at the very first verse of Ezekiel, we'll get mobile. Let me reassure you that Ezekiel is not nearly as difficult as most people imagine. Now, I know he had a rather unusual sort of personality, and he certainly saw some strange visions, but on the whole, his book is not too difficult. Once we have grasped the background, and we know who he's speaking to and what he's speaking about. And we'll get the clue from the opening verse, and then we'll go back to the book of Kings to sort it all out. Notice from the opening verse that it is in the 30th year, which means that Ezekiel is 30 years old at the time. We notice also that he was among the exiles by the river Kebar. That is, he was in Babylon with the people of Israel who had been taken captive. He saw the heavens opened, so there was something he saw in the sky, maybe thunder clouds and lightning and things like that, and out of this came some visions, which we'll see shortly. But the important verse is verse 2. It's the fifth day of the month and the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin. Correctly, he should be Jehoiakim, but I'm going to call him Jehoiachin so that you don't get him mixed up with somebody else whose name sounds a bit similar. Now, before we go any further, let us consider what this is, this fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin. Just leave Ezekiel there now, and we'll go back to 2 Kings chapter 24, and for the next 15 minutes or so, I want to have a look at the whole of the historical setting for this book. And once we have that straight, I think we're going to find that the book moves very freely. I'm going to move through the book from beginning to end without jumping backwards and forwards. I'm going to start at chapter 1 and finish in chapter 48, moving consecutively through. But first of all, 2 Kings chapter 24. Now, just to refresh your memories, the ancient nation of Israel, after Solomon, had divided into two kingdoms. The northern kingdom, which continued to call itself Israel and had approximately 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom, which called itself Judah and had, roughly speaking, 2 tribes. And these two kingdoms carried on their history in parallel form through the books of Kings. The northern kingdom, Israel, fell into idolatry, and round about the year 722 BC, it was conquered by Assyria and the people taken off into captivity. All we have left then is the smaller kingdom of Judah in the south, and this is the kingdom we're concerned with. The kingdom of Judah, with its capital still in Jerusalem and the Davidic line of kings still ruling in Judah. But the time we're at now, Judah is on its last legs. Babylon has now become the chief power of the region. And in the year 605 BC, Babylon first took over control of Judah. And the king of Babylon took captive into Babylon a select number of choice young men that he found among the upper crust families of Jerusalem. And among those was Daniel. Not many, but carefully chosen youths whom he could take to Babylon and train them to be administrators in his kingdom. Because Judah had just fallen into his power, so if he had Jews that he could train to be his administrators, well, of course, that would help his kingdom no end. The king who was in control of Judah at that time, the Judean king who was on the throne of David at that time, was a man called Jehoiakim, and Jehoiakim was frightfully bad. When Babylon first came and took control of Judah, Jehoiakim had to pay tribute, pay taxes to Babylon. But Babylon was fairly busy getting the rest of its empire under control, and so as long as it got its money in its pocket every year, it didn't bother too much about Jerusalem and Judah. With the result that Jehoiakim felt it was a ripe time to rebel. And so chapter 24, verse 1 tells us that in Jehoiakim's days, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant, and for 3 years he served him. But then after 3 years, he turned and rebelled against him, with the result that the king of Babylon encouraged some of the other nations round about, the smaller tribal peoples, the Chaldeans, Syrians, Ammonites, Moabites, and other people, to come and carry out guerrilla attacks on Judah, and so needle away, just make a nuisance of themselves, and keep Jehoiakim busy until such time as Nebuchadnezzar himself felt he had the time to come back and deal with Judah properly. And he did that in due course. And so we go through then to the year approximately 598 BC, which was the last year of Jehoiakim's reign. Nebuchadnezzar came this time. Now this is his second attack on Jerusalem. The first attack, remember, he took just Daniel and a few of the choice young men captive. But this is his second attack, and it is a far more worthwhile attack as far as Nebuchadnezzar is concerned. The worthless Jehoiakim had apparently been betrayed by his own people, handed over to Babylon, and was to be taken off captive. And his 18-year-old son, Jehoiachin, the chap we just mentioned in Ezekiel verse 1, Jehoiachin became king instead. But Jehoiachin ran for only 3 months, and he found that it was utterly useless to resist the Babylonian siege any longer. So he surrendered, and that's referred to in chapter 24, verse 8. Jehoiachin was 18-year-old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months. Down to verse 10. At that time, we are told, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against Jerusalem and besieged it. In verse 11, going on to verse 12 rather, Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, gave himself up. He surrendered. He realized after 3 months' resistance that it was useless to resist any further. With the result that in verse 13, Nebuchadnezzar came and attacked Jerusalem. He carried off all the treasures of the house of the Lord, that is, he plundered the temple, and also he plundered the palace. He stripped the place of anything valuable he could find. And in verse 14, he took away all the administrators, princes, mighty men of valor, craftsmen, anybody who was of use to him, he took off into captivity into Babylon. And none remained except the poorest of the land. Verse 15 tells us that the king's mother was taken, also the king's wives, the officials, and all the chief men. And among these was Ezekiel. This is now our second attack by Babylon on Jerusalem. It's the time that Jehoiachin is taken captive, and among those taken captive is our friend Ezekiel. But not all the people are taken captive. There are still many left back in Jerusalem and in the villages round about. And over these people who are left back in Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar appointed Zedekiah to be king. Last word in verse 17, Zedekiah is the new king. Zedekiah, incidentally, was another brother of Jehoiakim, another descendant of David. But Zedekiah was frightfully weak. He found that there were two main factions in Jerusalem. There were those who wanted to go along with the present setup, who realized it was useless to rebel. They may as well submit to Babylon because this was God's judgment upon the nation and there was no sense trying to get out of it. Now that was what Jeremiah said. Jeremiah lived during this time. In fact, Jeremiah and Ezekiel are contemporaries. Jeremiah is in Jerusalem bringing God's message while Ezekiel is in Babylon bringing God's message. And Jeremiah's message was this: don't rebel against Babylon. This is your deserts. God had warned. Now it's happened. Babylon has invaded. And you may as well submit. If you try to rebel, you'll only make things worse for yourself. But there were others in Jerusalem who wanted to rebel, and they favoured going to Egypt to get Egyptian aid, and then with Egyptian help, they would be able to overthrow Babylon. And Zedekiah is playing ducks and drakes with these two. He's one of these chaps that runs with the hares and chases with the hounds. And in the end, that sort of person gets himself into a lot of bother. And in fact, any community, even the church, where you find people like that, you normally find that in the end they create more trouble than they're worth. Well, that's what happened with Zedekiah. He got everybody else into trouble, and of course he got himself into trouble as well. In the end, Babylon could stomach him no longer, and so Babylon came and invaded Jerusalem for the third time, 587 BC. And this time, they did the job properly. They destroyed the palace, they destroyed the temple, they burnt all the buildings, they smashed the civic buildings, the houses, smashed down the wall, and they left Jerusalem a heap of rubble. Zedekiah got his deserts too. He was taken off into captivity. Now that's what is spoken about in chapter 25. A couple of important points here. Notice the last line of chapter 24 tells us that Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon, and he rebelled with Egyptian aid. Just file that away. It's going to be referred to in Ezekiel a number of times. Notice also the first verse of chapter 25. It's the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign and the tenth month. And it's then that Nebuchadnezzar lays siege to Jerusalem in verse 1. In verse 2, we are told it was besieged until the 11th year and the fourth month, verse 3. from the 9th year and the 10th month to the 11th year and the 4th month is, of course, 18 months. And during those 18 months, Jerusalem just about starved to death. And the horrors of that siege are depicted in the Book of Lamentations. At the end of the 18-month siege, the Babylonians broke through the walls. Verse 3 of chapter 24 refers to the famine, which was very severe in the city, and that again is going to be referred to in Ezekiel. In verse 4, a breach was made in the city, and the king, Zedekiah, with all the men of war, fled by night. Notice this verse again, because here again we're going to find in Ezekiel that these things are all referred to. A breach was made in the wall. The king with all the men of war fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls by the king's garden. It was some secret way he knew out behind the palace. He could nick off down the back of the lane in the dark, get through a hole in the wall, and scat off into the night. Some king, what? He was the first one to flee when the heat was on. Like a lot of the dictators in some of the banana republics of the world today. We know the story, don't we? As soon as the heat's on, who's the first man out of the country in a jumbo jet? The king, or the leader, or the president, or the army chief, whoever it happens to be. Well, Zedekiah is no better. But he didn't get very far, because in verse 4, the Chaldeans, that's the Babylonians, were after him. They caught him in verse 5. In verse 6, they captured the king. And in verse 7, they killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. And then they got hot sticks or pokers and poked Zedekiah's eyes out. Gruesome characters in those days. They then bound him in chains and took him off to Babylon. Thus we come to the end of Zedekiah. That is still not the end of the story. Because as it reads on, in verse 9, they burnt the house of the Lord, as I mentioned previously. They burnt the palace and all the other houses and all the great houses around the place. Verse 10, they broke down the walls of Jerusalem. And it goes on through verse 11 to say that they carried into exile all the people that they could find, and the only ones left behind in verse 12 were the poorest of the land that Babylon had no use for. And they were scattered around the villages and the farm hamlets round about. And over those people they appointed Gedaliah, another Jewish official, to be governor. Gedaliah was not king, but he was governor over these dribs and drabs of people left behind in the land. But we're not going to talk about Gedaliah. We've got enough of the background now, so we'll go back to Ezekiel chapter 1, and now we'll pick up the story. Ezekiel was a priest, and of course he had lived in Jerusalem. No doubt he was looking forward to taking his place in the temple. 30 years of age, just the right age to take up his official duties. But instead of taking up his official duties in the temple, he got a chain put round his leg and he was taken off into captivity. He may have wished, of course, that he would go back and ultimately serve the Lord in the temple in Jerusalem. And it was the hope of many of those people who went to Babylon that the captivity would be short-lived. And within 2 years, 3 years, they could go back and they'd be back in Jerusalem and things could carry on as they were before. No doubt Ezekiel had that sort of hope. But God says to him, Ezekiel, you are not going back to Jerusalem and you are not going to be a priest in the temple in Jerusalem. You are going to stay here in Babylon, and you are going to be a prophet. Let us understand the word prophet. Basically, a prophet is a person who announces the will of God to the people. In simple language, he's a preacher. He's a person who brings God's message to the people of his time, and that is consistent right through the Old Testament. Right from the beginning, where Aaron was Moses' prophet. Aaron was Moses' mouthpiece. He was Moses' spokesman. A prophet is a spokesman, a mouthpiece for God, a person who speaks on God's behalf. Now, of course, in doing that, he announces judgments, which will fall on people if they disobey God. He announces blessings, which will come upon people if they obey him. And so prediction was part of his message. Obviously, that was part of what the preacher was on about. But what I'm saying is this, don't get the idea that all he was a sort of cleaned-up magician, a type of fortune-teller, but on the right side of God, rather than being an occult type of character. That's not really a correct understanding of the prophet. The prophet was basically a preacher, and in the course of his preaching, naturally he spoke of things that were going to happen. But unfortunately today we think of a prophet in terms of a person who tells you if it's going to rain tomorrow or something like that. He is simply a forecaster. Well, that's the modern understanding, but that's not the biblical understanding. The great feature of the prophet was he came and he said, "Thus saith the Lord." That's what a prophet was on about. In fact, you might say that's a definition of the prophet. He was a man who brought God's message and who said, "Thus saith the Lord." That was to be Ezekiel's ministry in the future. While Ezekiel was there in Babylon, Jeremiah wrote them a letter. It's referred to in Jeremiah chapter 29. And in the letter, he said to these people, "Don't think that you're going to come back to Jerusalem in the near future. You're not. You're going to stay in Babylon for a long, long time. So settle down, build houses, marry, produce children, bring them up, plant gardens and vineyards, because you're going to be there a long time. Certainly the people will come back, but it will be maybe your children or your grandchildren. A total period of approximately 70 years would elapse before the people would come back." So Jeremiah dashed any hopes they might have had of a quick return. Now, there were plenty of false prophets around, and we're going to meet these as we move through. And these false prophets were saying, "God will be kind to you, and you'll all be back in a few months or a few years." And they thought that the temple in Jerusalem meant that they were safe from attack. They said God would never allow the Gentiles to go into his temple. He'd zap them on the spot. He'd atomize them with some fire from heaven because the temple was holy. And they thought the temple guaranteed their security. And they found out that it didn't. And the temple was destroyed. So that was what Jeremiah said, and Ezekiel says much the same thing. And when Jeremiah's letter came to these exiles in Babylon, they certainly were left in no doubt that they were going to be there for quite a while. Ezekiel began his ministry here in the fifth year of his captivity, and we know it lasted at least until the 27th year, because he says so later on. And as you read the story, you find that it spread on even further than that. So for more than 20 years, Ezekiel brought God's message to these people in Babylon. Now, the early part of his ministry was largely a denunciation of the sins of the people, both the people in Babylon who were still sinful, but particularly the people back in Jerusalem who were even more sinful. And he was saying to them, "Jerusalem is going to be destroyed." Now, just get clearly in our minds this fact, that at the time Ezekiel starts his ministry, Jerusalem has been attacked for the second time, and all the craftsmen and the most useful people have been taken into captivity. But Zedekiah is still ruling over the rest of the people back in Jerusalem. Jerusalem has not yet been destroyed. So Ezekiel begins his message between that second attack and the final destruction. And what he is saying is this: the sins of Jerusalem are such that it will not escape, and you people in captivity will not go back to join your fellow Israelites in Jerusalem. On the contrary, the people in Jerusalem will come and join you here in captivity, because Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. Now, that's the early part of Ezekiel's ministry, and that's what's talked about in the first half of his book, approximately. And then eventually Jerusalem did fall. And when Jerusalem fell, suddenly the people realized that Ezekiel wasn't as silly as they thought he was. They treated him as a bit of a joke because he did do some odd things. But when Jerusalem fell, they realized that this man had to be listened to, and the things he had forecast did come true. He was a prophet of the Lord, and his ministry proved it. And so you find then Ezekiel moves on to the second part of his ministry, which is concerned with preparing the people for the new age that lay ahead. That is the restoration of the land and the migration of the people out of captivity back into Jerusalem. A number of brief notes before we get started. The life of these people in exile was not with a ball and chain around their ankle. Don't think they were locked up in prison. They were captives, they were exiles, and they lived in large labor camps. They worked for the government for nothing. But their ordinary personal lives were lived with a fair amount of independence. They were able to plant cabbages and grow leeks and garlic and have a few chickens and ducks and things like that. They lived more or less independent lives, but with Babylonian guards around them, and they worked for the government for nothing. That's why you find these slave camps referred to a number of times. But understand the word slave camp in a little bit easier, you might say, a little bit more relaxed than what we would picture. It wasn't like some Nazi concentration camp, that's what I'm saying. It wasn't as bad as that. Secondly, there is no distinction between Israel and Judah. So if I use the word Israel or use the word Judah, I'm not speaking in terms of the divided kingdom, I'm simply speaking in terms of these people in captivity or the others back in Jerusalem. And if I want to make a distinction between the old northern kingdom and the old southern kingdom, then I will do so specifically. And the same applies to the way Ezekiel writes. He makes no distinction. except on one or two rare occasions, and then he points out very specifically what he is speaking about. And the third point is concerning Ezekiel's symbolic actions and his symbolic preaching. A lot of preachers in those days acted out their messages. I'm not suggesting you follow suit, particularly when you see some of the antics these chaps got up to. But you read the story of Isaiah, and he was an odd one. You read Jeremiah, and he was an odd one, and so of course is Ezekiel. But he got the message across. You can't deny that. And there's no doubt that from the visions he had, he must have been an unusual person. Different characteristics he had. He was a bit clairvoyant, you might say, in modern terminology. A bit eccentric. A lot of the prophets were a bit eccentric. Well, Ezekiel, we find, is a bit like that. But we also find he's a very precise person, and he gives dates and figures for nearly everything. And in that we can see something of the priest's concern for the exactitude of the rituals that the temple required. Now all of those things are just by the way, but you'll notice them as we go through. I now want to get started and get through the first three chapters. And this will lay the foundation. We'll be moving considerably more quickly once we get onto the chapters after that. Okay, picking up the threads where we left off, Ezekiel sees the heavens opened, and as he is sitting there, the Lord says something to him in verse 3. The word of the Lord comes to Ezekiel. Notice it mentions he was a priest, he was in the land of Babylon, he was by the river Kibar. I'm reading, incidentally, from the Revised Standard Version, loosening it up a little bit here and there as I take the liberty. He sees a great storm in verse 4. Stormy wind, and there are clouds whipping around, and there's thunder and lightning. And out of it comes this appearance, as it were, of fire, gleaming bronze and the like. And in verse 5, from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures. The four living creatures, we are going to be told later on, were in fact cherubim, or cherubim if you wish. Cherub is the singular, and in Hebrew the I-M on the end of a word is simply the plural. One cherub, two cherubim. Well, here are four cherubim. And these cherubim were the symbolic guardians of the throne of God. You have them over the Ark of the Covenant, and they feature in a number of the visions in the Old Testament and also in the book of Revelation. These four cherubim are arranged like this. They've stretched their wings out so that the tips of their wings touch. So you have four sides of a square, with one of these creatures on each of the sides, wings stretched out, touching at the corners, to form a hollow square. And we're going to see that this is a representation of the chariot throne of God. We're not going to go into all the details. So many people start Ezekiel, they get into chapter 1, oh, goodness me, they throw up their hands, they say, how on earth can anybody understand that? Well, I haven't set any sort of assignment for anybody to do in the break, such as draw your own picture of Ezekiel's vision of chapter 1. There's nothing like that. As long as you get the overall thrust of it, I think you've got the main thing. And the main thing is this. It is the chariot of God. It's the throne of God. But it's a mobile throne. It can move anywhere. And that's the point of the wheels. You know the old wheels within wheels we talk about? It's not very mystical. All it means is this, that there was a wheel this way and another wheel at right angles to it, so that the thing could go in any direction. An ancient form of our modern caster. We push lounge chairs around on casters. This was the idea. It was to get the message across that this was God's throne, but it was a mobile throne. And you're going to find that features all the way through the story, that the throne moves around in different places, showing that God is here, then God is somewhere else, and God moves around. So we have this hollow square, verse 11. The wings were spread out. Each creature had two wings, and each of which touched the wing of the other. You go down to verse 13, and you find that in the midst of the living creatures, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire. Now remember that also, because that will feature as we move on. This burning coals of fire in the middle of this hollow square. And the whole thing was full of eyes, it was alive, everything was moving. It was full of flame and fire jumping around. The whole thing was alive, darting to and fro, we are told in verse 14. And then verse 15 talks about the wheels, so that it could move in any direction. But the important thing is in verse 22. Over the heads of the living creatures there was the likeness of a firmament. Now a firmament is a solid platform. Something that was solid up there, over the top of the living creatures, shining like crystal, this platform. And that was to support the throne of God. So the picture's developing, isn't it? We have the four sides of the square. The cherubim make up this square. There's a platform over the top of them, and sitting on the platform is the throne of God, referred to in verse 26. Above the firmament, over their heads, there was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like sapphire, and seated above the likeness of a throne was a likeness, as it were, of a human form. But you find that this, as you read through a little bit further, is in fact a vision of the Almighty. Such was the appearance of this in verse 28, halfway through the verse, such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God, that Ezekiel, when he saw it, fell upon his face, and he heard the voice speaking to him, and the voice, of course, is the voice of the Lord. In summary, then, Ezekiel has a picture of the Almighty enthroned in glory, and what he does is fall at his feet and worship. And there's no doubt that we will do the same as our appreciation of the Almighty is increased. We are overcome as we contemplate the glory of this person. But when he fell to his feet, God stands him up again in chapter 2, verse 1, and he calls him Son of Man. Now that expression is going to be used consistently through the book. In some versions, you'll find it translated mortal man. It means, in other words, that Ezekiel is addressed as an ordinary human being, in contrast to the mighty one who is God on the throne. God stands Ezekiel up, and in verse 3 he says, Son of man, I send you to the people of Israel, to a nation of rebels who have rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me to this very day. The people also are impudent and stubborn. I send you to them, and you shall say to them, Thus says the Lord God. There's the picture. He is to be a prophet, as it goes on to say in verse 5. They will know that's a prophet among them, because a prophet was a person who said, Thus says the Lord. God says to Ezekiel, I'm going to send you to take my message to this rebellious nation. In verse 7, you shall speak my words to them. Whether they hear or refuse to hear, you preach nevertheless. Now that's going to be expanded in chapter 3, but let us file it away at the beginning. That's one of the basic principles that we'll come up against time and again through the Bible. We are never to excuse ourselves from announcing God's word by saying that they're not going to take any notice. How do we know they're not going to take any notice? And even if they don't take any notice, well, that's their problem. But we are never excused. And I'm afraid that we all fall into this trap. We have all at some times said, what's the use? This person looks a little bit warm. We'll witness to them because they look a bit more likely to become Christians. But these others are rather rough characters, and they obviously aren't going to believe, so what's it really matter? This sort of prejudice we have in our minds, and that's no excuse, really, is it? That's no excuse for not doing what we're supposed to do. How do we know, anyway? We all know of lots of people that you would never have think would have believed, and yet they have. Whether they hear or whether they refuse, that makes no difference. We have a responsibility, and we've got to discharge our responsibility. So that's the basic message for Ezekiel, and I believe that's the basic message for us. Verse 8, you son of man, hear what I say to you. Be not rebellious like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give you. And so I looked, and behold, there was a hand stretched out to me, and a written scroll was in it. He spread it before me. It had writing on the front and on the back, and there were written on it words of lamentation, mourning, and woe. So I ate it, says Ezekiel. Incidentally, this is a vision. All of these things are visions. Don't think of Ezekiel having indigestion and all that type of thing. He's having some sort of, he's in a trance or a vision. Something's happening, and all of these things are occurring. You and I have had dreams. Weird things have happened in dreams, haven't they? We've managed to do things we could never do in real life, and all sorts of crazy things happen. This is a vision, so don't get strung up when you say Ezekiel couldn't really eat a scroll because the wooden bit would get stuck in his throat. All he's saying is this. God says, Ezekiel, here is my message, and you eat it. You must make it your own before you can give it to somebody else. Now that again is the message for you and me. If we serve God in some way, no matter what it is, if it's teaching the word or it's preaching or it's running a Sunday school class or leading a Bible study group or a young people's group, giving the word to somebody else, we cannot possibly do it effectively unless, first of all, we have made it our own. We've got to make it our own. It's no good parroting off what somebody else has said. It's no good just reading from a book. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with studying a book or studying lesson material, but we've got to make it our own if it's going to have any ring of reality about it. And so God is saying to Ezekiel, if you are to be my mouthpiece, then before you speak the word, it's got to mean something to you. And so Ezekiel ate it. And it wasn't bad at first. He thought, this is rather sweet. End of verse 3. It was like honey. Not too bad at all, taking the word of God inside you. And I'm sure that that is an experience that we've all had at times as we've studied the word and it's penetrated into our innermost beings. We've said to ourselves, this is great. But the more it burns in, the more it tends to have a few side effects. And we find now that this is what happens with Ezekiel. As he realizes what's involved in this mourning, lamentation and woe, he starts to have a certain amount of second thinking, so to speak. It's going to be a tough word, and it's going to announce judgment as well. And nobody worth his salt really enjoys announcing judgment. Only a person who's a bit cynical or sadistic would enjoy that. But it has to be done nevertheless, bitter though the experience may be. And so that's what Ezekiel is finding out. This is the preparation. And this is the sort of preparation that God goes through with all of us in one form or another. But the basic principles, I think, are there. He says in verse 7, the house of Israel will not listen to you. Well, that's not very promising, is it? Ezekiel, go and preach to the house of Israel, but they won't listen to you. Well, most of them won't anyway, because they're not willing to listen to me. All the house of Israel are of a hard forehead. They're hard-headed, he says, and they're stubborn-hearted. Verse 8, behold, I have made your face hard against their faces, and your forehead hard against their foreheads. In other words, God is giving Ezekiel a special toughness because he says, Ezekiel, you're going to be banging your head against a brick wall. And if you've got a soft head, you'll maybe drop your bundle after a while. You'll find the going tough. So he says, I'm going to give you a special toughness. And I believe that all of us have got to work pretty hard at giving ourselves a special toughness. Too many of us are too thin-skinned. We've got to work hard at developing a thicker skin so that we are not offended. We're not put out by the awful things that happen to us and that are said about us and the opposition that we run into. We're not to be super sensitive. Often that super sensitivity, concerning ourselves that is some form of pride. I believe we've got to be like Ezekiel and work at developing a certain degree of resistance, a certain degree of toughness, so that we don't go and run away scared as soon as something happens to go wrong or somebody says something against us. Ezekiel is being prepared. Well, we come to the end of the vision and the chariot throne departs. Verse 14, the Spirit lifted me up and he took me away and I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit. Well, that's a change, isn't it? Back in verse 3, the word was as sweet as honey. But now he finds that serving the Lord is not all fun and games. It has its rewards. It is uplifting. But it also has its tough spots. And God has no place for a coward. And so he goes away realizing that what's ahead of him, in spite of the pleasant aspects, is on the whole going to be a tough assignment. We all need to be aware of the implications of the Christian service we undertake. I believe too many people go into Christian service with a warm feeling in the heart, a tingle down the spine, and they think that's going to carry them through. And after a while, they run into obstacles and things happen, and so they drop their bundle. Here, Ezekiel is being told, and I believe we need to be reminded, that we are not to undertake things for the Lord lightly, but we are to realize that it is a battle. Enjoyable work in many ways, but yet with this touch of frustration that's going to try even the best of us. So Ezekiel goes away now with a few second thoughts, but he's dead sure that he's going to do what God said to him. The hand of the Lord was upon him, and in verse 15 he came back to the camp where the exiles were. He sat there overwhelmed for 7 days. That's an interesting one too. 7 days, waiting again for the word of God to have its full effect upon him. That's a consistent theme that you notice in the Bible, that God doesn't seem to be in a hurry the way we are. Here we find that the man, just for the next week, just went quietly. He sat there and he let the whole thing soak deeply into his soul. The Word of God is something that must penetrate, and the work of God is something that is not to be undertaken lightly or rashly. Well, at the end of the 7 days, in verse 16, the Word comes again to him, and God says to him, "Son of man, I've made you a watchman." Now, we all know what a watchman's there for. The watchman is there so that as he sees the enemy approaching, he can warn the people in the city that an attack is about to break out against them. God says to Ezekiel, "I have made you a watchman, and you are to warn these people." I'm sure we've all read these verses at some time in chapter 3. And they're going to crop up two or three times through the book. I don't think I have to elaborate upon these very much. I'm sure that the Word, as it stands, is so penetrating and so clear to understand that its effect on us is pretty well automatic. We all surely must take stock of ourselves as we read these words. For example, verse 17. "I've made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall give them warning from me. If I say to the wicked, 'You shall surely die,' and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way, in order to save your life," in other words, you do things simply to look after your own reputation and comfort, "and that wicked man dies in his iniquity," well, okay, he dies in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand because you didn't warn him. You refrain from warning him because you were frightened he was going to call you a rude name. So he says, you are responsible. On the other hand, verse 19, "If you warn the wicked and he does not turn from his wickedness or from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have saved your life because at least you did warn him." Now, in both cases, the man dies. It's up to him what he does. But the point is, he says, have you warned him or have you not? If you have, you've discharged your duty. If you haven't, his blood I require at your hand. Come then to verse 24. "And here the Spirit entered into me," says Ezekiel, "and he spoke with me and said, 'Go, shut yourself within your house.'" It appears that Ezekiel was confined to his house for a certain number of hours each day. You're going to find that a lot of funny things happen to Ezekiel. For example, in verse 25, we find that he's bound with cords. That is, his movements are restricted so that he cannot go out among the people. Verse 26, something happens to his speech so that he's not able to speak. These restrictions are placed upon him. Now, it's quite obvious as you read the next chapter and the next chapter and the next chapter that Ezekiel was not permanently tied up in his house and he was not permanently dumb. But there were some restrictions upon him, and perhaps it was that for several hours each day he went through this ritual of being bound. Or perhaps God did, on certain occasions, strike him dumb so that he couldn't speak. He could only speak when God told him to. The significance of it is this. He is to give God's message as God directs. "I will open your mouth," verse 27. "I will lead you out into the people to take my message when my time comes." And the whole thrust of verses 25 and 26 is that Ezekiel is not his own boss. He is not free to come and go and say what he likes. He is under the total direction of God. If he's confined to barracks, he's confined to barracks. If God tells him to go outside and take a message to the people in the market square, then he goes outside and does so. If God keeps his mouth closed, then he can't speak. If God lets him speak, then he does so. Once again, a very graphic way of getting across to Ezekiel, and I trust getting across to us, the fact that we are to be responsive to God, we speak his word, we do his bidding, we obey him when he tells us to do certain things, and we obey him when he tells us not to do certain things. And that is the message there at the end of chapter 3. Well, that now lays the introduction. That's the call of Ezekiel. We haven't yet got our teeth into the book, but I think we've got a launching pad. And now from chapter 4, we'll move on to look at the actual messages of Ezekiel and see what he has to say to the people.